tennis ultimately, as well as having a disability, has allowed me to embrace those setbacks and see them as more of problem-solving opportunities. My first goal that I have is going to be a Paralympic Games. For us, we had to be top 22 in the world to qualify, and I was ranked, I think, in the 30s at that time. And I was like, do you know what? I have a year to qualify. I'm going to do it. And people were like, you're insane. Like, kind of tough to do. And I was like, watch me. Like, hold my beer. Here I go.
Right. So, right.
There's always someone that came before you. If you then get the opportunity to be that person that comes before someone else, it's your responsibility to act accordingly. It's your responsibility to represent your own legacy, but then also the legacy of the sport that you get to compete in and represent.
All right, welcome to the Tennis Worthy Podcast, brought to you by our friends at the International Tennis Hall of Fame. I am Patrick McEnroe, the current president of the Hall of Fame, of which I am very proud to occupy that position. And one of the things I get to do as the president is to host the Tennis Worthy Podcast. And we have so much fun on this show. We talk about different themes every month. And the theme in May is dedication. And nobody that encompasses the word of dedication better than our guest today, Miss Dana Mathewson, who is one of the all-time great wheelchair players in American history. First female player to win a major in doubles. That was at Wimbledon a couple of years ago. So thank you so much for joining us here on Tennis Worthy. We are very excited to hear from you and to hear about your dedication to the sport of tennis over the years.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to chat.
So, tell me how, first of all, you got into tennis. I know you had an illness which forced you to be in the chair, but were you into tennis before that, or was it just when you had the injury and the illness that you then got into wheelchair tennis? Give us a little background on that, if you could.
Yeah, so ironically, did not like tennis at all when I tried it on my feet. I was a really active kid growing up. My mom signed my brother and I up for like every extracurricular under the sun, and tennis was one of them during the summer. And I remember thinking it was slow, which looking back is crazy. Like, there's nothing slow about tennis. Maybe I was slow at the time, but I didn't like it. And then soccer was my sport of choice. And when I got hurt, it was actually at soccer practice, just to kind of explain the SparkNotes version of what happened. I was at soccer practice running sprints. My back started to hurt extremely badly. I'm 10 years old, so I'm like, what is going on? I've never, you know, have no clue what's going on with my body. My coach tells me to just run it out, like it might be cramps or something. And so I do, and my feet got heavier and heavier. I remember it felt like someone was filling my shoes with lead. And then the pain worsened. Cut to like an hour later, I'm lying on my living room floor at home just screaming. And It was like someone just flipped a light switch. And I looked at my toe, tried to move it, and it was like nothing. Everything was gone. I couldn't feel anything below my belly button. I couldn't move anything. They rushed me to the hospital, found out that I got a really rare autoimmune disease called transverse myelitis, which is like a fancy way of saying my immune system thought something was wrong with my spine and attacked it, the same way your body does when you have a cold or a flu. And that left me paralyzed, so I have to use a wheelchair now. And yeah, it changed my life. So I honestly had never heard of wheelchair sports. I'd never heard of anything adapted before, much like a lot of the people that are probably listening to this right now. And my mom talked to all sorts of rec therapists when I was in the hospital. And she was like, you were an active kid before. I don't care that you use a wheelchair now. You're still going to be active. And she signed me up for all these different camps, just like she did when I was able-bodied.
Right.
So I did. She has a theme. So I tried wheelchair rugby, which everyone hears about, like murder ball. I tried basketball. And eventually tennis was the one that just clicked. If I'm honest with you, I had a lot of reservations about wheelchair sports. I'd never met anyone that was disabled that wasn't like 90 years old. So I was like, this isn't for me. Like, anything that's new is scary, right? And I was like, this isn't for me. I'm not going to fit in. It's like, you know, what is wheelchair sports? It sounds like an oxymoron. Like, how could that be competitive? How could it be worth my time? And I was so wrong about it. Picked up a racket, loved it. And now I'm here chatting with you.
Amazing. Well, it's incredible to have you, Dana. And thank you for taking the time to talk to us here at the International Tennis Hall of Fame. When you look back to those first couple of times that you went on the tennis court, right, that you were in the chair, what are your memories of how that felt at the time? Like, you're trying different things out. You're trying to figure out, you know, what am I going to do the rest of my life as an athlete, someone that's, as you said, you loved sports, you love soccer. What are your memories of those first couple of times you got on the court? Was it like immediate?
Yeah, I think it was. I remember picking up a racket, hitting a forehand. You know, it was at a camp, so they're feeding us balls and just doing drills. And something just clicked. I just loved it. And I think a little bit more than sport, it gave me a sense of freedom again. So much of my life felt like it was taken away from me when I lost the use of my legs. And like, it's your independence, it's your sense of self in a way. I was entering that time of my life where everyone's really self-conscious about how they look. You know, it, especially as a girl, there was just a lot tied into that in terms of how I felt about myself. And so to sit in a sports wheelchair, to be moving around quickly, to be around other kids that were also like me was really empowering. And just adding the tennis aspect of it, things just clicked. Like, I loved it. It just felt like a little spark of something kind of ignited in me, and I was hooked.
Well, you had it, obviously, you just retired from playing professionally. So I know you're looking, in that we all go through that transition, right? When you retire, I know you got a lot of things on your plate, including you were working at the Miami Open that just finished recently. So well done on that. I know you have a lot of things on your plate moving forward. But when you were starting out playing wheelchair tennis as a teenager, what was it like competitively? I mean, I know that, their wheelchair tennis has gotten more and more popular over the years at the majors. And obviously, you guys have your own tour as well, that you were the dominant American female player for many years. But what was it like initially as a teenager when you started getting into not only the game more, but the competitive side of it? What was it like for you at that point?
Oh, I loved it. I'm a really competitive person by nature. I always have been. My mom always likens me to like a football player. Like, if I want something, I go like first down, second down, third down to get what I want. And that obviously translates into being an athlete. So I think for me to compete again felt great. I loved it. It was an outlet that I was missing after my injury, but it was also something new because I grew up playing team sports. So it was new for me to be a singles player. You know, also I played doubles, but being out there alone, getting to test myself, having to ride the highs and lows of problem solving a match and doing all of that as a teen was really exhilarating. It was also frustrating. As you know, as a tennis player, tennis
Yes.
can be very humbling.
Yeah, no kidding.
But I loved it. I think it was a way for me to make friends. It was a way for me to get out of the house. It was a way for me to do all the things that tennis offers for people when they're not a professional athlete yet, right? Like, it's a social aspect of your life, but it also kind of let me tap into my competitive side. And it was also a release for probably a lot of the frustrations that I was holding on to in terms of what was happening to me or what had happened to me. So I think tennis was, it was a lot of things, but it was definitely an outlet more than anything in my teenage years.
Oh, no doubt about it. And like you said, I mean, I tell parents all the time in our tennis academy that I run with my brother in New York City. I was a pretty successful professional player.
Above average for sure.
Maybe a little bit, but when I tell these stories to the kids and the parents, especially, I always say, you know how many tournaments I won in my career as a singles player? One tournament, one time in my career. I walked away having not lost. And that's difficult, no matter who you are, whether you're able-bodied, whether you're in a wheelchair, whether you're doubles, singles, it doesn't matter. I mean, you have to deal with these losses all the time. And I think, you talk about, we're talking about dedication. The other word I think of as becoming a successful tennis player is resilience.
For
And
sure.
obviously, you had resilience in a whole different, world with what happened to you. And then, you combine that with then the competitive side of tennis, it teaches you a lot of life lessons, doesn't it?
Absolutely. I think that a lot of people, unless you're within that tennis competitive space, don't really realize to go back on what you're talking about, that tennis players, unless you win the entire tournament, you are losing every week. And so you have to get very comfortable with the highs and lows of feeling successful and feeling like a failure. It's a little bit dramatic to throw words like that in, but that's how it can feel sometimes. And I think that tennis ultimately, as well as having a disability, has allowed me to embrace those setbacks and see them as more of problem-solving opportunities, which I think also ties into how to be a successful tennis player. problems present themselves to you all the time when they're in a match, whether it's on the court, off the court, and you have to figure out ways to get around them or turn them into successful opportunities. And I definitely have had to do that navigating life with a disability. And I think that ultimately made me a better tennis player.
Well, yeah, no doubt about it. We're talking with Dana Mathewson here on our Tennis Worthy podcast for the International Tennis Hall of Fame. I know you're down in Orlando now, living down there, working some with the USTA. They've done a tremendous job at the facility there with player development, which I ran, by the way, for a number of years.
Dana, I know.
Sen and I worked alongside some of the wheelchair coaches down there that are just tremendous. And I know some of them had a huge impact on you. So what's it like sort of for you now, as someone who's just recently retired? You know, I know your coach Jason has done so much for you and for wheelchair tennis in general. To maybe for you now to start to give back a little bit and put your experience into the younger people that are coming up in wheelchair tennis.
Oh, it means so much to me. I think you know as well as anyone that tennis is actually a really small world. Like, everyone knows each other and everyone has kind of had a helping hand at some point of their career from someone that has done it before them. And that's, you know, I'm no exception to that. And especially in the wheelchair space or Paralympic space, it's even smaller and it's even more of a community of helping each other kind of get lifted up from the ground up. And my career definitely was started from someone gifting me a tennis chair, showing me what it's like to be disabled and being an athlete. And that was even possible, that you could be a professional and have a career, go to college, etc. And so for me to be able to mentor our younger players, to coach them, to kind of be an example of what life can be like if you work hard and, you know, commit to it the same way our able-bodied counterparts do, anything's possible. And so I think that honestly matters to me more than anything now that I'm in my post-career era.
Right. Transitioning. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, even this afternoon, I'm going to go coach some of our players and I'm already thinking about like a lesson plan. What can we do? What did I like as an athlete? How can I relate to this player versus another one? And again, to go back to the problem solving aspect, I find myself still doing that just in a different way now. And I'm really enjoying it.
Yeah. Give me a little more on when you went to, I know you were in Southern Cal, you're in the San Diego area, where you grew up. Then you ended up in college in Arizona, right?
Yes.
Okay. And did you play a lot of tennis while you were in college? What was that like leaving your high school and then going into college? How did you combine the two?
Yeah, I was actually recruited to go play tennis at the University of Arizona. A lot of colleges are really growing out their tennis programs now, but at the time when I was going to college, which seems a little too long ago, they had a really strong program there. So I was recruited to go. I never thought that as a wheelchair athlete that I'd be going to a D1 school to compete, which was an incredible opportunity, and I absolutely loved it. That was my first foray into having like two-a-day practices, you know, the required lifts, all of that, which was great. And that's how I eventually started to also compete on our ITF circuit, get a professional ranking. And that's kind of how everything sort of snowballed.
And you mentioned to me when we were just chatting before we started the interview, when I forgot to hit record, which happens quite a bit. And I need a lot of helpers around me. But the point is that you then went off and lived in England, right? After you finished college. And was that for wheelchair tennis? Was that the reason you moved there? What was behind that move?
That was a big part of it. I think, you know, we have a tour the same way the able-bodied side does. So we have the European swing, we have the Asia swing, but a lot of our tournaments are Europe focused. And so for me, I was like, why am I spending all of this money flying transatlantic all the time? And because I was in California, West Coast, I was like, I'm flying across the US and across the ocean, like all the time, wasting my money. Let me like set up a base over there.
Right.
And so I did that. And I was also studying. I got a master's in audiological science over there. So if you have ear problems, I'm your girl.
Wow. Okay. I love that. Wow. Very cool. Yeah.
So I was doing two things at once over there. And it ultimately was a great time in my life. I lived there from 2017 till 2020, right before COVID. And, you know, finished my schooling over there, competed over there, actually got to train a lot with the LTA and a lot of their players. And yeah, so it's like a second home for me over there. And then I eventually finished my degree, came over here and was like, I'm going to commit full time tennis. So where else would I do that other than at player development? And that's why it took me to Orlando after that.
Oh, very cool. No, it's, you know, we tennis players have to deal with that travel and you know, the I think of the Australian players that.
Oh my gosh, yes.
Yeah, end up, you know, coming and living, you know, they're on the road for 9 months of the year.
I could never be Australian. I don't have the wherewithal to do it. Like, I love Australia, but no way do I want to be on a plane flight for like 24 hours just to get anywhere.
I know, it's crazy. But I, you know, I watched your Instagram post when you kind of announced that you were retiring from professional tennis, and it was so cool because, you know, I saw your photos of, you know, playing at Roland Garros, playing at Wimbledon, but, you know, the friendships, like, and going to all these different places, and you talked about that in your post, and it kind of hit me because I am, you know, been lucky enough to stay in tennis my whole professional life, with as a player, as a coach, now, you know, as a broadcaster for so many years. And one of the best things that I always tell people about being a tennis nomad, as we are, right, is all the people that you become friends with that are from all over the globe. And, you know, every time I go to Wimbledon every year, or I go back to Australia, you know, I get to see the guys I played with that are now, you know, we're all in our late 50s, we all have kids, and, you know, so on and so forth. And you kind of have your own life away from tennis, but tennis is still, you know, such a huge part of who I am, and obviously a huge part of who you are too.
Yeah, it's everything. I think my journey's been a little bit unique in that when I first started out and when I was transitioning into being a professional, I didn't have a team, so to speak. Like, wheelchair tennis is much more professionalized and commercialized now than it was when I was starting out. So I didn't have the money to pay for a full-time coach or to travel. I kind of had to pick one or the other. And so I put it all on red. Like, I put everything onto the travel aspect. And I was kind of adopted by different coaches overseas. I learned from all of the different friends that I made on the tour. And so I think that's why that mattered to me so much. Like, so much of the skill set that I have now before I got to come and train at PD was acquired on the road. And it was acquired from different coaches that lended their expertise to me when they didn't have to, and competitors of mine that did the same. And so I'm really grateful for that. It really does take a village. Like, tennis is an individual sport, but you know as well as anyone that it's a lot of work from people that put hours into you to create this being that they hope just goes and is successful. And so I'm eternally grateful for all of the different coaches that I've had, for coaches of other players that have told me things that they didn't have to tell me. And yeah, I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for everyone else's input.
Trust me when I tell you, Dana, okay, some of us that started out on the professional tour as well, years before you did, no coaches. So I had no coach.
Right?
Yeah.
It's not a unique concept.
No, not at all. And, you know, you see all these, you know, famous players now, and even the famous wheelchair. I mean, as you see the wheelchair players, they got full teams now too, the top wheelchair players, like the top able-bodied players. So it really has changed for the better, you know, that the players are able to get so much help. So I look at your resume. I mentioned the Wimbledon title, you know, 32 overall doubles title, 16 in singles. But you, first of all, I'm like blown away by the fact that you went to London basically by yourself. And it sounds like you were just traveling as a young woman on the tour by yourself for the most part. So that's incredible. It doesn't matter if you're a young woman or a young man. That's hard to do no matter what. And to be working your way up, right, through the ranks. So what was your goal? What was Dana Mathewson's goal when you started playing professional wheelchair tennis?
You know, my initial foray into pro tennis was that I just had the mindset of I want to qualify for a Paralympic Games. I think so when I first set that goal for myself, for us to play at a Grand Slam, we could only be in the top eight in the world, actually top seven, because they afforded the eighth spot to a wild card.
Wild card, right.
And usually that went to someone from that country. So luckily I kind of had the in with the US Open, but for any other slam, that's really hard pool to get into. And so I was like, do you know what? My first goal that I have is going to be a Paralympic Games. For us, we had to be top 22 in the world to qualify. And I was ranked, I think, in the 30s at that time. And I was like, do you know what? I have a year to qualify. I'm going to do it. And people were like, you're insane. Like, it's kind of tough to do. And I was like, watch me. Like, hold my beer. Here I go.
Right.
So that was my first goal. And then I qualified for Rio. And then I just got the bug. I was like, I want to get better and better. I want to get in the top 10. I want to get in the top 8. I want to qualify for slams. And I did it. I think I'm not dissimilar to any other athlete that you talk to where I set little incremental goals and then I want to reach them. I want to be as best as I can be. And I'm a perfectionist like a lot of tennis players, you know. Yeah, it was just all about the pursuit of perfection, the pursuit of being as good as I can be. I'd be lying if I said I thought that I reached my max. But I think that, you know, in terms of my potential, but I think that I'm not also dissimilar to many athletes that will say that even though they've retired. But I think I just reached a point where I couldn't give what I needed to give to be a professional athlete anymore. And I wanted to pursue other things. But, you know, I still love the sport. I miss competing, but I don't miss being on the road all the time. And I don't miss some of the other sacrifices.
That's what I said. I used to, when people ask me now, they'll say, oh, because I do all the television, or you travel so much. I said, yeah, I travel a decent amount, but nothing like when I was playing on the tour, 9 to 10 months a year, basically on the road now. Okay, 2 to 3, not so bad. It gives my wife and I a little distance, you know, which is not a bad thing when you've been married for 26 years. So I know you recently got married. So congrats on that. And you mentioned, you know, doing some other things. So tell me, you talked a little bit about the coaching, which I know you're going to continue to do, but what are some other things that are interesting you and that you want to continue to pursue now that you're done with your playing professional career?
Yeah, so I think a big thing that I want to do is to continue to raise the profile of wheelchair tennis. Like we touched on a little bit before, it's getting really professionalized and getting really embraced, especially at the high level. Like I've seen at Wimbledon, they sell out court one. They, you know, it has a lot of attention in Australia. And I want to have that happen in the U.S. I think for whatever reason, we're really behind. I think culturally, we're slower to embrace adaptive sports because it's seen as a little bit more cute as opposed to an athletic pursuit.
Serious sport, which it is. Yeah.
Right. And I think a lot of people like yourself, once you see it, you're like, oh, wow, these players are, yeah, they're moving around on wheels, but a forehand is a forehand. A backhand is a backhand.
Totally.
Serve. Yeah. And I think I want to spread that message. And so I'm actually going to be helping out doing some commentary at the US Open.
Awesome.
And yeah, and I think that is something I'm really passionate about. I want to take that to other slams. I want to help commentate at other Masters 1000 events. I want to organize more tournaments like with Miami. So that's a big thing that I'm interested in. I also do want to carry on the mentorship, the coaching. All of that matters to me. And then outside of tennis, I think anything that I can do in terms of speaking engagements to raise awareness of people like myself, my story, what that means to have a disability, how I can make the world more accessible in terms of attitudes towards disability matters to me a lot. I think that despite my resume, like you can talk to me and be impressed with me because of what I've done, but the average person that sees me on the street still thinks of me as less than. And that's frustrating just because I use a chair, someone talks slower to me, or they think that I can't drive a car, or they think that I can't go grocery shopping on my own. That happens to me more often than not. And I think that a lot of the answer to that is just having exposure to people like myself. And I think that if I can use whatever platform I have to raise awareness about that and people like me with tennis as a vehicle, then that's what I want to do.
That's awesome. And Dana Matthewson joining me here on our Tennis Worthy podcast for the International Tennis Hall of Fame. And by the way, Dana, I'm glad you mentioned that about the American fans and at the U.S. Open. And it's not just wheelchair tennis. Let me tell you, it's, you know, I played in the seniors, you know, the old guys over the years, doubles, you know, I was
doubles,
a very successful.
Yeah,
I was much more successful as a doubles player than as a singles player. And, you know, now there's this issue that the USTA is trying to make, you know, change the mixed doubles format.
I was going to ask you about
that. Create a little controversy. But here's my point. My point is that we in the U.S. struggle a little bit more with, you know, the U.S. Open is massive, obviously, because it's an event. And
yes.
So is Miami and so is Indian Wells. But some of the smaller events have struggled. Like you said, your wheelchair matches at Wimbledon, doubles matches, senior matches at Wimbledon are played on court one with huge crowds. I mean, my brother and I would play in the Legends doubles. And, you know, sometimes my parents might be there. And that was, you know, there's not many more than that. Like you're playing junior tennis again. And, you know, you got John McEnroe there, a guy who's won, you know, 7 U.S. Opens in singles and doubles. So anyway, my point is we're all in this together.
Yes.
You know, trying to promote the sport, trying to grow the sport, and trying to, I think, educate the American public about what a great sport is that tennis is, because we're sort of a little lower on the totem pole. And to your point about wheelies, you know, that how amazing the athletes are that are wheelchair players, and that this is, and I've seen it because I've tried to play in the wheelchair. I mean, it's, I have. It wasn't pretty. Trust me, it wasn't pretty. And my arms need to get a lot stronger to do that. But it is amazing to think that how far, you know, the U.S. Open has come, because I was there in the years when it was at Forest Hills, and also how far wheelchair tennis has come. I'm interested to hear you mention that it was more difficult to get into the majors than it was to get in the Paralympics, which you ended up getting in three times. Has that changed a little bit? Because the draw sizes have gotten a little bigger now, right, in the majors, in wheelies.
Yes, it's changed a little bit. The U.S. Open was actually the first slam to increase its draw size to 16. So that was really exciting. And I think all of the slams have now done that, with the exception of Wimbledon. But that's still harder to get into than a Paralympic Games. So I think that, you know, it's on its way to getting better, but I can also understand the slams hesitancy, just because it's a whole nother division. It's a lot of athletes that you're bringing in.
Right.
And so to give us a huge draw of even 64 is not necessarily feasible right out the gate. And I think you want to make sure that the product that we're showing there is as great as it can be, because it's still something where they want to make money. They want to bring fans in. And so I could understand initially having the top eight there, but I think that we can at least have 24, you know, something like that. And I hope that it continues to trend that way. But yeah, as of right now, it is still easier, quote unquote, to represent your country at a Paralympic Games than it is at a Grand Slam.
So what was that like to represent the country as you did multiple times in the Paralympics? I see the smile on your face. So I'm assuming that was pretty damn cool.
Oh, it's huge. I think, you know, all of this stuff that you see with the team processing for the Olympics, where you're going and getting all of the gear and, you know, you're living in the village. It's such an honor to represent your country. And I think just to tap into a little educational moment for anyone listening, a lot of people think that the para and Paralympic stands for paraplegic, but it actually stands for parallel. So what most people don't know is that the Olympics happen, say, take the recent Paris Games, for example. You watch the opening ceremonies, you see the village, you see where everyone is competing there, and then you hear about the Paralympics, but you think it happens somewhere else. It doesn't. It happens in the exact same venues. We stay in the same exact village. We have the same food, all of that. It just happens
a couple weeks later, right?
Right. Yeah. But a lot of people don't know that, which I think is something that I always try to push out and kind of help educate people. But yeah, playing for your country is huge. To represent your country, have the letters USA on your back is an honor that was never lost on me. I think I always played a little bit harder. Like, I always yelled to come on a little bit louder. Like, I always wanted it a little bit more. And yeah, those are genuinely, as cliche as it might sound, genuinely some of my most prized memories competing in those situations.
Yeah, I was lucky enough to be the coach of the Olympic team in Athens in 2004.
Oh, cool.
And it was amazing just to be able to walk in the opening ceremonies, to be part of the village, and to see the other athletes, you know, from around the globe, not only from your own country. And I think that's, you know, one of the great things, one of the challenges in our sport in tennis, Dana, as we've discussed, is, you know, making it more relevant in our own country. But when you look at how popular, and like you said, you went to Europe because that's where all the action was. That's from, and even now, you know, most of the top players in the top 100, men and women, are guests from Europe, although we're doing a little better now. U.S. players doing a little better. When you look at the kind of the history, and here at the Hall of Fame, you know, we've just recently inducted a couple of all-timers into the Hall of Fame. Esther Vergeer, who gave maybe one of the greatest speeches that anyone has ever heard here at the Hall of Fame in the last couple of years. Rick Draney as well, who's one of the pioneers of wheelchair tennis. So when you kind of look at that, these great players and trailblazers, sort of like you've become one of those too, there's a responsibility there, isn't there, to not only for you, but also for the sport of wheelchair tennis.
Absolutely. I think, you know, I grew up interacting with Rick Draney and Esther Vergeer. They were always like put on a shelf type of idols for me. And I think it's crazy and kind of like a pinch me moment to think that I'm that now for someone else. Like one of our juniors, actually, she's not a junior anymore, Maylee Phelps. She actually like dressed up as me for Halloween. She wanted to be me. And I was like, this is crazy. Like people actually view me that way. And I do definitely feel a sense of responsibility, a sense of humility and honor when it comes to that. And I think that, you know, like we talked about before, there's always someone that came before you.
Right.
And I think if you then get the opportunity to be that person that comes before someone else, it's your responsibility to act accordingly. It's your responsibility to represent your own legacy, but then also the legacy of the sport that you get to compete in and represent. And if you don't do that, that tarnishes not just your legacy, but it has a domino effect. And so I think that my mission now is, although I'm not on the court competing, I can still uphold that legacy of what wheelchair tennis is, promote the sport for what it is, and, you know, act accordingly, try to inspire more people the way that I was inspired by the Esther Vergeers, by the Rick Draineys. And if I can do that and have that domino effect for someone else, then I've done my job.
Yeah, well, there's no doubt you've done your job and you're doing your job. And we hope that and we can see that you will continue to do your job, to be dedicated. Again, that's our theme here on Tennis Worthy this month. Dedication to your sport, to your craft, to wheelchair tennis as well. Tell people that are listening here or watching, Dana, where they can keep up with what you're doing. I know you have an Instagram account, but I know you have a website. So let us know where people can follow you and see how you continue to affect wheelchair tennis.
Yeah, you can find me pretty much on all the different socials. Instagram, if I'm honest, is the one that I update probably the most frequently. So just
right.
Type in my name, Dana.Mathewson. I'm also on, you know, Facebook. I've got a website, DanaMathewson.net. Just Google me and you'll find me. I'm easy to find.
Well, we're happy we found you at the International Tennis Hall of Fame. And we hope you make it up here one time. We'd love to have you come and visit us up here in Newport.
I would love to see it.
We were just in the process of redoing our museum up here, which is opening shortly again. And many of the wheelchair players represented there, as well as the other Hall of Famers. So it's a pretty special place. You're a special person, Dana. Thank you so much for joining me. And we'll look forward to seeing you down the road and keep spreading the message that you're doing so well.
Thank you so much for having me. This was great.
Dana Mathewson here on the Tennis Worthy Podcast. Thank you for joining us.